Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All Federal Reserve banks are not created equal, you know. The New York Fed gets some congressional attention. How to make it as a YouTube star, I know you've been dying to know. And also, hey, buddy, how about 20 bucks for that aisle seat, huh? You all right with that? Our series, A Guide to Buying Just About Anything, continues from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Wednesday, gang. It is the 19th of November, and we got our semi-regular peek behind the curtain of the keepers of interest rates and monetary policy over at the Federal Reserve today. The minutes of the most recent meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee, as it's known, hit the streets, and we learned, well, to be honest, not too terribly much. They are not all that worried about what's going on in Europe or in China, apparently, which is good news, I suppose. But a member of the committee, one William Dudley by name, who just happens to be the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, is getting some extra congressional TLC this week. There's a hearing scheduled for Friday and some new legislation proposed just yesterday calling for more scrutiny and more accountability, not for the Fed as a whole, which you hear a whole lot, but just for that one branch in New York. Stan Alcorn tells us why the Big Apple is getting picked on.
There are 12 regional banks in the Federal Reserve System, but New York is special. It's a permanent member of the Interest Rate Setting Committee. The others rotate on and off. And as a regulator, it oversees the Wall Street firms that were at the heart of the 2008 financial crisis. Economist Simon Johnson at MIT says that gives it more power and more responsibility.
The problem there is that you have some very large financial firms which have a lot of political influence.
The worry is that that political influence has infected the regulator itself. This American Life and ProPublica gave ammunition to this argument when they published secret recordings of New York Fed regulators seeming to take it easy on Goldman Sachs.
Don't mistake our inquisitiveness and our desire to understand more about the marketplace in general as a criticism of you as a firm necessarily.
This relationship between the regulators and Wall Street has been way too cozy.
Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio called for this Friday's hearings after the tapes were released. He plans to push New York Fed President William Dudley to prioritize regulation. Simon Johnson of MIT likes a proposal put forward by Senator Jack Reed. He'd take the job of picking the next William Dudley from a board of business people and give it to President Obama.
The only way to break through this tangled web of connections is to have somebody who is appointed by the president of the United States.
The New York Fed wouldn't comment for this story, but in previous statements has rejected allegations impugning its regulatory integrity. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
There's big medical news today, courtesy of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, which said its investment in a drug to treat its namesake lung disease has paid off, and big time. The foundation is going to get $3.3 billion with a B dollars for selling its royalty rights to the treatment that it developed with Vertex Pharmaceuticals. It's a newish field, this is. You might call it venture philanthropy. The cost to patients of the drug that has been developed, by the way, said to be about $300,000 a year. Nova Sappho has the rest of that story.
When Vertex came out with its new drug, the price shocked David Orenstein. He treats cystic fibrosis at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. So Orenstein and a few colleagues wrote a letter to the CEO of Vertex.
Essentially saying, hey, we love what you're doing for our patients, but this price just doesn't seem sustainable. It doesn't seem right.
The letter got them a meeting with the CEO.
After the meeting, the price went up by $12,000.
The Cystic Fibrosis Foundation says it's had no influence over the price of the drug, and the research it funded was essential to getting the drug developed.
On the big picture, it's very similar to what almost all disease foundations do.
That's George Annis, a health law and bioethics professor at Boston University.
Most of them fund research by academics, but it's not a big leap to fund research by a biotech company on the theory that they're more likely to actually translate their research into a product.
But so far, foundations have not seen returns anywhere near the scale of billions. Dr. Peter Bach of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center says he won't be surprised if he sees big paydays again in the future.
This will be an outlier until it happens again, and drugs that get approved, even for rare conditions, can command essentially infinitely high prices.
And if foundations benefit from those prices, he says, they could face a conflict of interest. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
A word now about behavior, not yours so much as your kids and what they are doing in school. There's a classroom management app out there. It's called Class Dojo, and it keeps track of kids' behavior in class, just like it sounds. But the company has taken some heat this week for the data that it collects on kids and what it does with that data. So now it has decided to delete kids' records after a year. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has the story.
Class Dojo is popular. 35 million students and teachers and parents use the app. Teachers award points when a kid stays on track and takes them away when a kid talks out of turn. Teachers say the app keeps kids motivated, and it helps parents keep in touch with what's going on. Sam Chowdhury is the CEO of Class Dojo.
Class Dojo is not a data company. That's not what this business is about.
To prove it, Class Dojo says it'll start deleting student data after a year, a move privacy advocates applaud. Victor Meyer Schoenberger is the author of Learning with Big Data, The Future of Education. He says looking broadly at the nearly $8 billion education technology industry, one of the biggest worries
is that everything in students' past will be captured, collected, stored, and therefore remembered.
Basically, he says a kid could wind up with a permanent data backpack that follows her all the way through school, logging her successes and her transgressions. So Class Dojo's decision to delete data will help ease that concern for that app. But it doesn't calm other worries about classroom technologies used to monitor kids. Kalia Barnes is with the Electronic Privacy Information Center.
If a student is afraid that every single thing that she does is recorded and scaled and sent off to others who can make decisions about her life, well, then it can chill her speech.
Anne says Barnes, even if the data disappears after a year, the effects of that monitoring may live on. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Adrian's story is part of a reporting project we are doing on education and technology and where they meet. It's called Learning Curve. For all of her coverage and kind of an amazing graphic, really, on how student data is being collected, and there is oh so much of it, you should hit our website. It's marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, sluggish is a word I might use. You might differ. I don't know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Flying, as most of us know, isn't what it used to be. Not a whole lot of glamour. And every inch of seat room or leg room or baggage room, sometimes even pillows and blankets, not to mention food and drink, all of it comes with a price. Airlines make a lot of money from those fees, but what if there were a way to take all those costs and move them, say, under the table? As part of our collaboration with the New York Times this week, it's called A Guide to Buying Just About Anything. Marketplace's David Weinberg reports on the state of the modern bribe.
I started at the United Airlines ticket counter, offering the agent a $20 bill for a seat upgrade. She refused, acting as though this kind of thing happens all the time. At security, I tried to slip a couple of 20s to the officer manning the TSA pre-check line so I could breeze through without having to take my shoes off. He gave me a look that said, "Nice try." At the gate, I approached the line reserved for premium flyers, asking each person if they would switch seats for cash. One man shook his head, barely looked up from his phone. Another appeared confused. The closest I got to a yes was a couple who did not want to split up for the flight. Otherwise, they said they might have considered it. Once I was on the plane, I tried to switch places with people who had more legroom. No one went for it, which surprised me. I was willing to go as high as $100. So maybe I looked a little suspect to some people. I have a bushy beard, long hair. I could pass for a young Cat Stevens in the right light. So I called up Debbie, a flight attendant who asked not to be identified because she doesn't have permission to talk to the news media. Before working for the airline, she was a social worker at a mental hospital.
I was actually kind of surprised when I became a flight attendant at the general rudeness and lack of caring about other people that I saw in passengers on planes.
Now she's used to it. She wasn't surprised that no one would sell their seat. She sometimes has trouble getting passengers to switch seats to accommodate families, even when she offers free drinks or food, and the new seat isn't a downgrade. Once, while Debbie was flying off duty, the pilot announced that they needed to make an emergency landing.
The working flight attendants wanted to move me up front so that I could help with an evacuation if it was necessary.
So the crew asked first class passengers if one of them would give up their seat for her, but none of them were willing to move.
Luckily, we didn't need to evacuate, but, you know, it was interesting just that nobody wanted to move, even when a flight attendant is saying, this will help save your life.
I also ran my experiment by Tom Bunn, a former airline captain and licensed therapist. He, too, was not surprised by the reactions I got, but for different reasons. For many people, he said, the act of flying is incredibly stressful, not because of long security lines and cramped seats, but because of the psychological act of giving up control, of leaving solid ground.
When a person is actually involved in any decision, it's just difficult because they know that, in a way, it's a roll of the dice.
Settling into an assigned seat, he said, is part of the process of quieting their anxiety.
So for them then to simply say, I'm going to change seats then, what it could mean is, oh, the passenger in such and such a seat survived and the passenger in such and such a seat didn't. So there's, once again, the roll of the dice, and they don't want to think about it.
For them, my cash offer may have been an unwelcome disruption in their attempt to relax before a stressful experience. I also have my own theory that people may have been afraid that taking my money would have broken a rule and gotten them kicked off the plane. I contacted 6 airlines to ask about their policy regarding passenger-to-passenger transactions. Delta, American, United, and Spirit responded. Delta and American said they did not have any policy that forbids passengers from exchanging seats for money. Spirit only forbids switching to an exit row or to larger front seats, the airline's first-class equivalent. United has a similar policy. You can switch seats, but not cabins. Of all the upgrades I attempted, only one could have landed me in any real trouble, offering cash for access to TSA PreCheck.
Well, that's not how the program works.
Ross Feinstein is TSA's press secretary.
Bribing a federal employee, I believe, is illegal.
It does, however, seem to be legal to buy your way to the front of the TSA line.
The process begins for TSA from where you actually, where someone checks your ID.
Prior to that point, anyone ahead of you in line is fair game for a cash offer. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Our collaboration with the New York Times, it's called A Guide to Buying Just About Anything, is online, of course, and it is in the actual newspaper today. Check it out. It looks pretty good. Coming up.
They started out as billboard designers just for a billboard company, but then they became so successful that they went freelance.
You don't know their names, but you probably do know their work. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 2 points today, basically flat, ended things at 17,685. The NASDAQ down 26 points, 0.5%, 46.75 there. The S&P 500 gave back 3 points, 0.1%. Finished at 2,048. Tech led the markets lower. Facebook off 1.3%. Twitter flopped more than 2% today. LinkedIn slid 0.6%. IBM drifted more than 0.25% lower. Apple off 0.67%. Microsoft fell about 1% or so. Target reported good sales numbers and jumped 7%. Lowe's, though, hiked up 6%. That's a bit better there. Bond prices, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.35%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the National Association of Realtors releases existing home sales for October. On this day in 1923, inventor Garrett Morgan patents a 3-position traffic signal, bringing on what would eventually become the yellow light. And attention all peanut butter lovers and fudge lovers. Come together and celebrate Peanut Butter Fudge Day. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal, and here's today's word of the day for you. It's YouTuber. It's a noun roughly defined, as you might imagine, as people who owe their fame or their livelihoods or perhaps both to the videos that they post on YouTube. Their story is today's installment of our series, Screen Wars.
Television. got this.
No money down.
That one's in the dirt.
On a brighter note, commercial break.
There's been a crossover thing happening lately. YouTubers landing on network television shows and big ad campaigns, and a lot of them winding up in Los Angeles, which is rapidly becoming the center of the YouTube entertainment business. Marketplace's Queenie Kim has the story.
Meet Meg.
Hey, I'm Meg DeAngelis, and I'm a YouTuber.
DeAngelis is a college dropout who started making videos in the eighth grade when she was really into gymnastics.
Hey, everyone. Today, I'm going to be teaching you how to do a backhand. So I started by posting videos that were just like my hobbies. So I would have videos of like a backflip or something. It's really important not to hurt your wrist while doing stuff that weren't meant to be like a genre or like a channel.
But the videos got tens of thousands of hits, and DeAngelis kept making them. And she might have just kept it as a hobby, but things changed last year when she came to Los Angeles to visit a fellow YouTuber.
She kind of took me around LA, and I met so many other YouTubers.
It's sort of weird to me, like, I've never met YouTubers.
It was so weird to me, too. And to find out that they all live close to each other and hang out was really cool. I just wanted to be a part of that whole bubble.
And so DeAngelis dropped out of college in Florida and moved to LA to join a growing community of 20-somethings who are trying to make it as YouTubers.
I like putting, like, an insane amount of songs.
DeAngelis is showing me how she edits her videos, and these days it's mostly about fashion. In this one, she's modeling fall accessories that she made. I asked her, what's it mean to make it as a YouTuber? Is it a role on television or a movie? Maybe on reality TV, like that YouTuber Bethany Mota, who got onto Dancing with the Stars? But DeAngelis says she's not interested in acting.
I really want to have a clothing line because so much of my channel is about fashion.
For YouTubers, making such goals come true starts here in a large converted warehouse in West Los Angeles.
Enter the world of Awesomeness TV.
Jackie Coppell is the head of talent development at Awesomeness TV, one of a growing number of multi-channel networks on YouTube. This is how Awesomeness works. Anybody can start a channel and start posting videos to the network. At the same time, Awesomeness TV also creates original videos that feature YouTubers like DeAngelis.
So much of what we do is in-house. So we have editors, we have a production team, we have a scripted team, we have reality.
Coppell says when DeAngelis came to Awesomeness, she had about 250,000 subscribers.
Just about 8 months later, she's over 1.3 million subscribers.
And Coppell says Awesomeness helped DeAngelis do that by plugging her into its shows.
We have her in a scripted show with Royal Caribbean where she went on a cruise.
These branded shows are paid for by companies that want to promote their goods.
And then we also have her in some of our more beauty-focused content, like Makeup Mythbusters. That's a show that she sort of helms.
And remember, this isn't to launch DeAngelis into an acting career, but to get her a clothing line. Lisa Filippelli is an agent at Big Frame, which is an independent subsidiary of Awesomeness. She says lots of people mistakenly think of YouTubers as talent, like in the Hollywood sense of the word, as in actors, but
they're influencers, not talent. A talent is a person who just shows up to set, they do what they do, and then they're done.
An influencer is somebody who's constantly engaging with their audience, whether it's on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, or Snapchat. And Filippelli says these influencers get their audience to talk about stuff. And increasingly, they're getting people to buy stuff, too.
There's YouTubers on the New York Times bestseller list and selling out tours and selling massive amounts of product in stores.
And she says YouTubers are disrupting almost every segment of the teen consumer market. For example, instead of fashion magazines, teens are increasingly turning to YouTubers for beauty and fashion tips. Filippelli says with more advertising moving from television to video, that trend will accelerate. Back at DeAngelis' apartment, she's still waiting to make it. DeAngelis won't say how much she makes at Awesomeness, but she does say she's mostly living off savings.
When I was living with my parents, I didn't pay rent, so I just saved a lot.
DeAngelis worked odd jobs and also made money off the advertisements that ran on her YouTube videos. She says if she runs out of money, she'll probably go back to college. And while she's hopeful about the opportunities ahead, DeAngelis is also conscious that her time might be limited.
I can't do Vine, Snapchat, or like any of the new apps. Like I can only do like Twitter and Instagram and like the basic ones. And it almost feels like I'm getting like really old.
And how old are you?
I'm 19.
In Los Angeles, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
There is so much advertising around now. It is constantly in our faces that it's easy, really, just to tune it all out. Hasn't always been that way, though. And back before the Second World War, a whole lot of the visual culture in advertising, billboards and logos and early neon signs, was done or inspired by a married couple, Dorothy and Otis Shepherd. Norman Hathaway and Dan Nadel have a new book out on the Shepherds. It's called Dorothy and Otis Designing the American Dream. Guys, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Dorothy and Otis Shepherd. My guess would be not too many people out there have heard of them, but we all see their influence yet today. Norman, what do you think about that?
I would completely agree. It's kind of shocking considering how famous they were during their heyday, how invisible they are now. But yes, I'd say they really shaped a lot of the look for optimistic American design and visuals, without question.
And the interesting thing about that is they shaped it across many mediums. So everything from baseball uniforms to stadium design to resort design
to billboards
yeah. to Wrigley's gum packaging. They're kind of the first people to do total modernist design in America.
Also companies and enterprises, right? Obviously you mentioned yes. Wrigley's, but there's also Chesterfield cigarettes. There's sure. There's Pabst beer. I mean, there's all kinds of different things that they were into.
Yeah. Yeah, the Cubs. I mean, they started out as billboard designers just for a billboard company, but then they became so successful that they went freelance and worked directly with, you know, several clients, as you said, you know, Pontiac, Chevrolet, mm-hmm. All kinds of food companies.
Let's get to Otis Shepherd and Dorothy Shepherd as well, but Otis Shepherd and the Wrigley Company. I was gobsmacked to see in this book the designs for Wrigley chewing gum packs that you can still recognize today. I mean, this guy did the whole smash.
Yeah, I think that's the beauty of working within that period as well, is that there was one person overseeing everything. I mean, the only similarity perhaps in today would be someone like Johnny Ive from Apple, but even then right. he's only making the products. But the ability, as Ive has, to work directly with the head of a company to make sure that everything is looked after properly, but to cover whether it's packaging, advertising, you know, baseball player uniforms all from one company and have it all have a connected synergy is really something to see. And the amount of work as well is pretty incredible.
Yeah. And it came about because of a mutual respect that turned into a really a great decades-long friendship. I mean, P.K. Wrigley was not a man known to have many friends. He was not a socializer, not much of a public figure. But he and Shep were thick as thieves and would argue like brothers. But always in the end, we're best of friends.
Otis Shepherd is the guy who comes up with the Doubleman twins.
Yes, indeed.
That's crazy. Come on.
Yeah.
This is the guy who invented the Doubleman twins?
This is the guy.
Did he I read somewhere in this book, I think, that he said an advertisement, people ought to be able to figure out an ad in 5 seconds or less.
Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't like to even have any text, ideally, on billboards. He just thinks if you had a visual message, it should be able to sell it. And any text that was usually added was against his will, and he tried to keep things as brief as possible. But he was a very, very early little genius as far as considering branding and statistics. And really, he was rarely ever interested in just aesthetics. Everything he did was for a reason, and then the design would support that.
Well, we have to talk here about Dorothy Shepherd, who at a time when design and advertising and all of that was an intensely male-dominated field, she obviously was not a man and succeeded outrageously.
Yeah. I mean, the amazing thing about doing this book was indeed our, you know, quote-unquote discovery of Dorothy, which really came about because Norman was looking on Flickr for images and discovered one attributed to Dorothy Shepherd. And asked the person who posted it. The person turned out to be Otis and Dorothy's granddaughter, Erin. And
I screamed like a girl and emailed her privately and said, "You must call me." And then, you know, the whole
Pandora's box.
Our illness started from there of having learned it. But it was shocking. I didn't know Dorothy existed. But, you know, usually you're just excited to see that someone's a designer. And then the more research and the further we dug and seeing samples of the work, it was just shocking.
I mean, it's that level of expertise and also that level of vision and that level of curiosity. I mean, she really is the first American female modernist to be that successful.
If you like the modernist period, 1929 to 1950-ish, guys, you tell me.
Yeah, right? That's right.
Is that good? Yeah. If you like that period, there's some great stuff in this book. It's called Dorothy and Otis, Designing the American Dream, Norman Hathaway and Dan Nadel. Guys, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, you know what's not selling like hotcakes? Yeah, hotcakes aren't selling like hotcakes. From the pages of Bloomberg Business Week, this item: in the past 5 years, pancake mix sales are off 1.5%, which doesn't really sound bad, I know, until you put it into context. We spend, on average in this country, $1.16 per year per person on pancake mix, which is, if you do the math, about the same as buying one box of Bisquick every 3 years. Or you could just, I don't know, make them from scratch. It's easy. Flour, milk, all that good stuff. All right, we're out of here. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lange, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Rayfield, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.